meeting of the January 6th board meeting of the Eastern Municipal Water District Board of Directors to order. Nicole, if we could do a roll call, please. First, to make sure our attorney and all the other board members are on the line, that would be great.
Thank you. Director Pauly?
I am present.
Director Corona?
Here.
Director Slauson?
Here.
Director Armstrong?
Here.
Director Record?
Here.
General Counsel O'Neill?
Here.
Very good. Thank you very much. With that, why don't we stand for the Pledge of Allegiance. Director Slauson, would you be so kind as to lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance?
Sure. Please join after me.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
April, do we have any guests that wish to be recognized, or do we have any people wishing to do public comment for our meeting?
We don't have any guests in the room. We may have guests on the phone. No one has indicated that they want to speak.
Okay, very good. With that, we'll move on to item two, which is the Board of Directors election of officers. Mr. Jones, were you going to present this item?
Yes, sir. Thank you, President Pauly, members of the board. Good morning and happy new year to everyone. This item is for the election of officers and for the determination of outside committee assignments. Under the Municipal Water District Act, Section 71273 requires that the board at its first meeting in the month of January and each odd number year elect a president, and the board may also elect a vice president. Historically, Eastern has used a rotation for its officers and has implemented that throughout its history. Based on that rotation, Vice President Pauly would be in a position to rotate into president, and Director Randy Record would be rotating into vice president. Similarly, under that rotation, in the following rotation after that would be Director Corona, followed by Director Slauson, then Director Armstrong. On January 8th of 2020, the board also approved its outside committee assignments. These are typically reviewed annually. The purpose of the outside committee assignment approval is to authorize compensable meeting on the side of the board and to authorize that attendance. So we do have two items for the board to consider today. There's two resolutions included in your package. The first item in resolution is to approve the rotation and the election of Director Pauly as president and Director Record as vice president. And then the second item is to adopt a proposed resolution with the 2021 board committee and other outside assignments, and including memberships and assignments to outside organizations. So with that, unless there's any questions, perhaps just turn it over to the board for a discussion to see how it'd like to proceed.
Let me ask General Counsel first, do we need to take two motions on these, or can we do it in one motion?
I'd recommend two motions to President Pauly.
Okay. Very good. And before we make the motions, is there any discussion on the items?
I have no discussion. I'll move the authorizing the election and appointment of officers.
Second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded. Would I get a roll call, please?
Director Pauly?
Yes.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Thank you. Then could we look for a motion on committee assignments?
I'll make that motion.
I'll second it.
We get a roll call, please.
Thank you. Director Pauly?
Yes.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Very good. Thank you all. Thank you, Mr. Jones, for that presentation.
Thank you.
We will then move on to executive reports, and starting with the general manager.
While I'm up here, included in your board package is a brief report. I just want to update the board on two very quick items. First, as we've reported previously in the weekly report, the House and Senate did pass H.R. 133. This was an omnibus appropriation bill of $1.4 trillion that also included a $900 billion COVID relief bill. That bill was signed into law by President Trump on December 27th. There's a number of interesting provisions in there that, of course, we're following. Two, under the COVID relief bill, one, there was an inclusion of $638 million for low-income ratepayer assistance. That's going to be administered through the Department of Health and Human Services. That's something, obviously, we will be investigating and following up on. And second, there is a $25 billion provision in the COVID relief bill for state and local governments for assistance in payment of late rent and utility bill debt for eligible households. Those would typically be administered through the county. As you know, the county is trying to get up a program up and running under the CARES Act, in which it would provide through what's called the Community Action Partnership that the county organizes some rate relief for customers to clear debt off of their bills. So we'll be looking into those as they go forward and how we might put our customers in a position to avail themselves of those programs. Second, and very importantly, the appropriations bill included a Water Resources Development Act portion that contained the language modifying our Section 219 U.S. Army Corps of Engineers South Paris desalination authorization to provide that additional $25 million. So that was included in the bill that passed. That covers up to 75% of the cost for those programs. And I just think we will be certainly sending a letter thanking and recognizing our House and Senate congressional delegation for all the support we had on this. We just had fantastic support, and we put a press release out on this, on the $25 million funding increase yesterday. So that was very good news. Other items of interest to the board, at our next board meeting, we're going to be talking about our state and federal legislative priorities. One of those federal legislative priorities that we've been working on quite a bit is the restructuring of the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation's Title 16 water recycling program. We've been working very closely with the Water Reuse Association and other stakeholders who have existing authorizations as well as interest in the program in the future to essentially reallocate and provide additional funding for new recycled water projects, including and such as our potable water replenishment project. So as background, in 2016, Congress and the President signed the Water Infrastructure and Innovation for the Nation Act, or the WIN Act, which created a second Title 16 program that was a competitive grant program under the USBR. Under that program, if you have a project that's deemed feasible, you can competitively compete, and the Bureau will review your application and look at annual funding allocations under that. Prior to the WIN Act, though, Title 16 was in Title 16 projects were individually authorized. And so what that means is they would be authorized by Congress, and then they would be funded, and appropriations into those projects would be directly done by Congress. That occurred from 1992 to 2009. Projects were authorized. After 2009, because of the earmark ban, no further projects were authorized. But they continued to receive appropriations, the existing authorized projects. So just to give some perspective, there's 16 active authorized projects. We call them legacy projects. They're the older projects. And those projects are starting to wind down. But if you look on the WIN projects, the new projects that people have applied for, there's over 60 projects. But the problem is the way Congress appropriates funding right now, they're disproportionately appropriating funding into the older, the legacy projects. So, for example, in fiscal year 20, the Congress appropriated $40.6 million for the legacy projects and $20 million for the WIN projects. And what occurred was the legacy projects only asked for $16.6 million. So there was funding left on the table under the Title 16 program. So the concept we've come up with is, obviously, if you have a legacy project, you want to protect that project. but it's what we call a pour-over concept. And it would say Congress would appropriate a pool of funds, a large pool of funds, that they're currently appropriating in two pieces for Title 16. The legacy projects would be funded first based on their requests, and any remaining funding would then pour over into the wind projects. That way, it doesn't leave any funding on the table. The people with legacy projects have those projects protected and will get their support, but it will provide much more funding for new Title 16 projects. So we've developed the concept and drafted legislation for that with Vanscoyuc and Associates. We've worked through several stakeholders, and now the Water Reuse, National Water Reuse Association, is kind of taking the lead on this. And so they're reaching out to all the legacy project holders like South Bay, El Paso, et cetera, and trying to make sure they're comfortable with what we're proposing. And then we're searching for a legislative vehicle to insert this new language in the next Congress to basically clean up this problem with Title 16. So that's going to be a key initiative for us next year. And again, Jolene will be providing a federal update as well as Danielle, a state update on our priorities at the next meeting, and we could talk about that further. But I did want to let you know that is a key federal priority for us for next year. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for the general manager?
I have one question, just to follow up on that. So is this pour-over concept sort of an evolution? Was there before sort of the idea of deauthorizing some of those legacy projects that just have had no activity? And
yeah, and again, that was always kind of a previous approach was, well, you could put more money into the wind projects, but where are you going to get that with funding caps? Okay, you can then go back and deauthorize those. And again, that what happens is you find out that people who say, I have no interest in working on a project, suddenly have an interest. They say, well, we might do it in the future, and so you get resistance. But the idea is here is with the pour-over is you have one pool of funds. Nobody's ox is gored. The legacy projects, which are winding down quite rapidly, and their funding demand continues to go down, they can get the money they need to finish those projects out, and we can get them off the books. And then the program over time will just naturally matriculate to the wind projects. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great, approach. You take new concept. It's really good.
Thank you. And any other questions on this?
No questions.
Very good. That concludes my report. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Nick. Anything for us this morning?
I have nothing to report today.
You're good. Laura?
No, nothing today.
Mr. Mawad?
Good morning, Mr. President, members of the board. Just one quick item. Late in December, we did receive the funding agreement from the State Water Resource Control Board for our Quail Valley sub-area 4 planning efforts, and that's a grant in the amount of $500,000, which will support our current activities. As you recall, we had previously secured $200,000 grant funding from SAPA. So combined, now we have $700,000 to support our ongoing efforts. We are currently underway with our planning for sub-area 4, and once we have developed the findings and recommendations later this year, we'll be presenting that to the board. That's it.
Very good. Thank you, Joe. And Mr. Wall?
I have nothing today.
Very good. Thank you so much. With that, we will move on to the consent calendar. Do any members of the board wish to have either pull an item on the consent calendar for further discussion or have conflicts? Seeing none, I will ask for a motion and a second on the consent calendar.
I move approval.
I'll second.
Very good. Madam Clerk, could you call the roll, please?
Thank you. Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Very good. The consent calendar is approved on a 5-0 motion. That will take us to item 5 this morning, which is our action calendar. We will move on to 5A, which is to approve and authorize award a contract to Downing Construction Incorporated for $9.8 million under specification number 1400S, Sky Canyon Sewer Project, an additional appropriation of $12,438.
Good morning, and thank you. As you mentioned, this is the Sky Canyon Sewer Project Award of Construction Contract. The presentation this morning will include some information on background, pre-qualifications of bidders on this project, a summary of the bid results, support services during construction, as well as a recommendation to the board. The diagram you see on your right, it's largely presented in an orientation of north and south, at the top being the north. If you look at the northeast quadrant, you can see the outline of the French Valley Airport. And in the middle of the page, starting from the top down to the bottom, you see Winchester Road bisecting the diagram. You see a red line east of Winchester Road, and largely that is our alignment that we have selected for this project. It's undergone a very extensive alignment study where we've looked at considerations of public impacts, impacts on traffic, constructability, as well as cost of the project. And we have developed a project that avoids Winchester Road to a large extent, running parallel. Runs down south toward the intersection of Technology Drive and Sky Canyon, and runs along Sky Canyon Road to an intersection with Marietta Hot Springs Road. Kennedy Jenks was a designer for this project, and Kleinfelder was our geotechnical engineer. And what I want to point out on this diagram, up in the northeast quadrant, you see a brown area east of the red line, and you see a gray oval area. That's actually a rock outcropping from the ground, and this is one of the challenges associated with this project, is it's fairly deep construction, and you have the potential presence of rock. And we've done an extensive amount of due diligence with regards to the development of this project, and we are proposing this project to go open cut in this area. But based on the size of this project and the difficulty that may be encountered during construction, we did an effort to pre-qualify contractors, and I'll provide some more information about that as I go on with this presentation. This project is addressing growth in the French Valley area, and you can see the image on the right. It's the general location of the project. This will support the Temecula Valley trunk sewer system overall. It will install about 6,700 linear feet, a 36-inch line. In the prior diagram, Hunter Road was at the very north extent. That's where we start, at the intersection of Winchester Road and Hunter Road. This project will relieve stress. It's currently on a 24-inch sewer in Hunter Road, where it's running at or above the current design capacity. So it's a project that is needed now, and it is a project that has been planned to incorporate needs through build-out in this particular alignment. With regards to pre-qualification of contractors, I mentioned prior the challenges associated with the project, and staff issued a pre-qualifications for experience and liquidity for firms to pursue the project. In September 2020, district issued a request for qualifications. We had 13 respondents. Eight of them were selected as pre-qualified. They included companies like Contry, Downing Construction, Buntage, M&R, Rados, T-Shirt, Artukovich, as well as Rasic, all companies that we have some familiarity with and have confidence that they could pursue this project. In October of this year, past year, we issued an RFP to the pre-selected and pre-qualified contractors. Of the eight that were pre-qualified, we received seven bids. Downing Construction came in with a bid result that was substantially below the engineer's estimate in an amount of $9,844,113. I want to point out that the majority of the bids really are between $13 and $14 million. We did have a high bid in excess of $15 million. The engineer's estimate for this project is roughly $15,600,000. I have a lot of confidence in the engineer's estimate for this project. I think we have actually advertised this project during an advantageous period of time for getting bids. And did have some questions whether or not Downing could complete this project, and we did receive in writing that that their bid is valid, and they are willing to complete the project at their bid amount. So we're very fortunate, I think, to have a bid on this project at this low, considering the original planning estimates for this project. And Kennedy Jenks performed the design services for this project. They did a very good job for us. We do recommend that they be awarded the construction services, engineering services during construction, including field engineering support, submittal reviews, design clarifications, change order review, technical and special inspections, as well as preparation of record drawings. Our schedule for this project, we've completed the final design. We've advertised the project. We're approaching you today for consideration of the project. We would like to issue a notice to proceed as soon as possible, and we see that substantial completion of the project could likely be by the end of 2022, putting it in a good planning zone for completion of this project. A recommendation today before the board, award of contract to Downing Construction for the Skies Canyon Sewer under specification 1400S in the amount of $9,844,113, as well as a award of an engineering services contract to Kennedy Jenks in the amount of $118,075. An administrative award of contracts necessary for suppliers and consultants to complete the Skies Canyon Sewer under specification 1400S, and an additional appropriation amount of $12,436,893, bringing the total project cost to approximately $14,400,000. I'm available for any questions at this time.
Any questions?
I had one that I didn't have in ops and engineering. The two-year time frame for construction, it seems long. Is it the depth, the rocks? Is there something driving that
time frame? I agree. I think there's the contractor has a responsibility for establishing traffic control permits and going through the process. And I think we've noticed that there's been an extended time period for obtaining permits under certain circumstances. Obviously, a lot of this project is outside of major roadways, and that's one of the intentions of the project. It is also a deep construction, requiring specialized equipment and shoring. There is also a portion of the project that will be done by trenchless technology to cross an environmentally sensitive area. So there is a variety of different challenges that are associated with that project that have extended our duration.
Okay. Thank you.
I had a question, too, along the same lines of at least traffic control. Although Sky Canyon is not as used as much as Winchester, I do know it is a used road. Do we have a pretty solid traffic control plan with the contractor?
We have requirements on the contractor. We've also, as part of our process, we reach out to the local municipality obtain their acknowledgement of our intent to get a traffic control in this particular area, but the contractor will be responsible for traffic control plans.
Okay, because I do know that will at some point may become a challenge depending on how long we're in the roadway there.
You know, when we looked at some of these alternatives, the challenges were far greater. So this is a good compromise for this project.
Far greater.
And President Paul, I also want to add that we have been working closely with our public governmental affairs, and we've done community outreach, and we plan to do so for the entire duration of the project. So we're going to be very much in tune with the community's concerns.
Very good. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
No further questions. I will actually make the motion on this one.
A second.
Okay, with that, can we have a roll call, Madam Clerk?
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Thank you very much. Moving on to item 5B, which is to approve and authorize an interagency agreement with the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California for raw water service connection EM25, subject to a non-substantive changes. Good morning.
Good morning, members of the board. As the introduction indicated, this is a service connection agreement with the Metropolitan Water District, connection specifically EM25. This connection is really part of the San Jacinto Valley Water Banking Program. You can see by the red arrow that this is specific to the water banking, allowing us connection to various imported water supplies for groundwater recharge. The overview of the project you see here on the map, EM25 is on the right and left-hand side. The pipelines that are outlined, both existing and new, move to the east and ultimately connect to our enhanced recharge and recovery basins and the integrated recharge and recovery basins. I have a few slides that are going to zoom in on the particular site to give you a better feel for what we're constructing as part of the EM25 project and the other facilities related to it. Here is an overview of the properties acquisition. You can see in the green, that's going to be the Metropolitan-owned connection for the EM25 service connection itself. We have in the light blue our flow control and chlorination facility, and the purple to the north is for future expansion in the phase two of this project for building pumping facilities. So zooming in a little bit, as indicated, you can see from on the image there that the EM25 valve vault connects directly to the inland feeder / east side pipeline through the EM25 metering vault, ultimately moving through to the chlorination and additional flow monitoring metering station. and pushing out to the new 60-inch pipeline that will be constructed heading out to the ponds. And you can see there's a bypass to our existing 39-inch line in the. So the water delivery configuration, the point of demarcation between Metropolitan Water District and Eastern is there indicated at a valve just outside of the metering vault. And as you can see, we've zoomed in. So the service connection itself has the 42-inch high-performance butterfly valve. The board will remember it was an early procurement item with a value of $500,000, meeting Metropolitan specifications for flow control from the inland feeder. And the acoustic flow meter within the valve vault is approved and authorized by Metropolitan for monitoring flows along the alignment. So I have to apologize up front for the brutal amount of text on these next few slides, but we wanted to highlight a few of the key components. The inland feeder conveys water both from the State Water Project facilities and the California River Aqueduct to Diamond Valley Lake. Metering, currently the Department of Water Resources relies on Metropolitan's metering for flows on the inland feeder. Our anticipation within our agreement is that this will also be the practice for our metering facility, because we are monitoring at a much lower flow rate than the Metropolitan metering stations along the alignment. So capacity. Phase one, which is our current project, takes up to 42 cubic feet per second. Phase two, which was planned for beyond 2030, will allow expansion to 100 CFS. There is a 10 CFS minimum flow delivery required due to the accuracy of the meters. If below 10 CFS, they are not accurate enough for monitoring, so that is our minimum delivery amount. We've seen before the proposed facilities, and then for responsibilities and cost, Eastern is responsible for all costs related to the construction of the connection. We will be giving that back over to MWD once we're done, and then the established cost of water is at the standard Metropolitan water rates. The term, in perpetuity, phase two, which is the expansion to 100 CFS, will be based on mutual consent between Eastern and Municipal and Metropolitan. Some limitations on that expansion, because we'll be putting pumping facilities in, surge analysis will be required to verify that we are not going to be damaging any portion of the Metropolitan systems. Some of the other limitations, we are down the list from priorities for Metropolitan. Obviously, their first priority for the inland feeder would be to fill Diamond Valley Lake and supplement low Colorado River supplies. We are also responsible for any contamination with quagga mussels in our facilities. I had a sign onto that in the agreement. And there's obviously the possibility this is an interruptible water supply due to any necessary items that Metropolitan sees fit on doing repair or rehab of the inland feeder. Our schedule, everybody's reviewed it. We are bringing this forward to the board today. It is on calendar for Metropolitan, I believe, next month. We are expecting the pipeline cathodic protection to advertise in 2021. The M25 agreement, once it is fully executed, will allow us to send the connection itself out to bid. Plans are complete and ready. We're expecting our pre-procured valve to be delivered in August. The shutdown that we're trying to bring all of these pieces together is still scheduled for October of 2021, and ultimately we look to be completed with the project in 2022. So our recommendation today is for the board to authorize the general manager to execute the EM25 connection agreement with Metropolitan Water District subject to non-substantive changes. And I'm happy to answer any questions the board may have.
Any questions? Very good.
I'll move the item.
I'll second it.
Been moved and seconded. May I have a roll call, please?
Director Pauley?
Yes.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
So the item passes 5-0. We'll now bring this to item 5C, which is to approve and authorize an agreement with Garrett Fleming for $625,000 for preliminary and final design of the Steeplechase and Kamala Booster Pump Station Replacement Project and an appropriation in the amount of $979,000. Good morning again.
Thank you again for the introduction. As a matter of background, this is a design award for the Steeplechase Kalamea Booster Pump Station System. The Steeplechase Booster Station was built in 1969 and pumps from our 2085 zone to our 2194 zone, located, you see on the map here, north of the 60 in the foothills of Moreno Valley. The current station is suffering from structural degradation of the actual building. I've got a photo of the building coming up on a slide. So our project objectives are to improve safety, efficiency, and reliability, and to make the facility easier for operations and maintenance to take care of and run. And we needed to locate a new piece of property because the existing property is not big enough to actually build another station on. You can see in the photo, this is an existing bunker-style station, half buried within the property. Very compact, very nice, very difficult to maintain. We get the crews in there to work on it when they're needed. And due to some past earthquakes, we have some structural damage to the facility. So the scope of work for the engineering services is data gathering, looking at the various properties. We have four that are have been identified by our planning group that we're going to do further evaluation on, the standard geotechnical and survey work. And so in our preliminary final design, you can see there from the list of items that the consultant is being contracted to do. So the selection process. We issued a RFP in September of 2020. The selection panel consisted members of the engineering staff, the planning staff, and operations team. The evaluation criteria is listed there. So the selection summary, Gannett Fleming was unanimously selected by the panel as the top-rated consultant. We received three proposals overall. We had reached out and invited eight firms. Our schedule, presenting today for recommendation for award of the construction, the design contract, we would, if approved, we would look to hold the kickoff meeting towards the end of the month and complete the preliminary design in June of next year. Our recommendation today is to approve an agreement with Gannett Fleming in the amount of $625,827 for the design of Steeplechase and the Steeplechase Pump Station and Pipeline Project, and an appropriation in the amount of $979,400 to fund project costs through preliminary design. And that brings me to the end of the presentation, and I'm happy to address any questions.
Any questions? So,
President Pauley, I have a question.
Okay.
If I'm reading that right, it's a year and a half for design. Can you kind of tell me why it takes that long for a design?
Yes, sir. We actually have to, as I mentioned earlier, we have four project sites that we are potentially be building a station on. The 18 months of design allows us to acquire, complete the CEQA that we needed on the identified property and then purchase the property. So the design itself does not take 18 months. It's the extended process to get us to
a... The queue might be up there.
Say again?
Did you lose Director Rickard?
No, that wasn't me. I don't know who that was.
Oh, that was Steve. I'm sorry. Do you have further questions, Director Rickard?
The key word is CEQA there, it sounds like to me.
Yes.
Thank you.
Well, if there are no questions, I'll move approval.
I'll second.
We have a motion and a second. May we have a roll call, please?
Director Pauley?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Director Rickard?
Aye.
The item passes 5-0, and that takes care of our action calendar for the morning. We will move on to informational items and presentations. The first item is item 6A, which is a board discussion on the fiscal year 2020-2021 approved water and sewer rates. This is an item that the board asked to be brought before the board at the last meeting. And, Mr. Jones, you are going to proceed with the presentation.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Yes. Once again, this item is brought forward to provide the board information and opportunity to have a discussion on how it would like to proceed relative to the 2021 approved water and sewer rates that were implemented January 2021. So the presentation's organized to provide some background information on kind of how we got here with the rates and charges, what our budget expenditures are, what the approved rates were, how they were derived. We have some representative bills for different types of customers and customer classes. Also, because, again, we're looking at this in the context of affordability and issues related potentially to COVID-19, It's important to really look at the entire region and understand how we are providing our service relative to others in the region and what those costs are in terms of real dollars to customers who we essentially have a shared economy with among our sister agencies. Also, just want to remind the board of the Proposition 218 notice results. And also, there's several other considerations we really need to take a look at, both politically and otherwise, with respect to what's going on in Sacramento. We do have a recommendation and then a opportunity for the board to have a substantial discussion, hopefully, and provide some direction. So let's go back to just a quick recap of the budgeted expenditures. Director Record, I'm on slide 4 for your information. So this provides a summary of the biannual budget expenditures that were adopted in 2019 with the proposed budget. Our operating expenses are projected to increase by 4% in 2020 and 2021. If you look at the two round charts there, they break it down by the various components of the expenses. Fiscal year 19-20 is on the left. Fiscal years 20 and 21 are on the right. The most significant increases we saw throughout the budget process where the overall expenses went from $406.5 million in 19-20 to $430.2 million in fiscal year 2021 relate to kind of three large areas. One is our purchased water costs. That increased from $75.4 million to about $78 million. Also, our water and sewer operations, $55.4 million for water up to $57.8 million, and on sewer, $63.6 million to $65.7 million. Our CIP expenses have also increased. That went from $70.9 million to $84 million. And again, of course, our operating and our operating budget, the way it works is we do have a net margin that we apply to our capital program and our debt service costs. So in looking at the expenses and assumptions versus actual, kind of where are we? We did provide the first quarter budget to actual review with the board. We projected a 4.6% and 3.8% increase in the operating costs for the two fiscal years. And as I mentioned, bear in mind, that's not just for core operations. The operating margin contributes to operating fixed assets, our OFA budget. So when we replace facilities that, you know, and equipment and things like that, vehicles, our other post-employment benefits, our OPEB obligations, our replacement and reliability capital projects in the CIP, and of course, it makes our debt service expenses. So in talking to staff and looking at kind of what experience we've had and what we're seeing as far as inflationary-related expenses, they really break down on the bottom part of this chart on page 5. And we have seen a met average rate increase of 3%. January 1st, 2021, of course, that will go to 4% January 1st, 2022. That was projected to be higher. We were able to work with Met through Director Record and others to get that down to a 3%, which is what we actually included. We included the 3% in the budget document. Also, our MOU negotiations, when you look at health insurance, the implementation of the class and comp study, rather, the cost of living, and again, those related insurance, if you kind of bundle all that together, it's about a 6.9% adjustment for fiscal year 2020. The energy costs really were quite high. Jeff can speak to this, but we saw a 22% increase in fiscal 2020. We're anticipating a 12% increase in fiscal 2021. The third phase of our solar initiative will be coming online next year. We do have renewable energy projects which help us hedge against that, but our purchased energy costs have gone up from Edison fairly precipitously. And also we've seen a big spike in chemical costs. We've seen polymer and sodium hypochlorite in particular. As you recall, we've converted all the plants over to sodium hypochlorite from gaseous chlorine. And on the polymer, that's an essential requirement that we use in the wastewater treatment process. And so we've seen polymer actually go up quite a bit by about 51% this year. and 6% for sodium hypochlorite. So in general, we are really not in an environment where we're seeing kind of stagnant expenses. We have inflationary expenses, and we have priced those into the budget and included in the budget. And again, those are reflected in the rates and charges. So let's go back to the process and what the rates were for fiscal year 2020 and fiscal year 2021. So I'm going to start out with water, and then I'll build out with sewer, and then we'll look at some combined rates and some comparison. So going to slide 7, Director Record, this shows the water rate. The adjustments were an annual 3% increase in the commodity rate, and I'll show that you how that breaks down into the commodity rate itself, and a 90-cent per month increase in the fixed charges for fiscal 20 and 21. On the sewer side, we had a 3.8% increase in rates. Of course, we have a multi-tier sewer rate, which I'll talk about in a moment, and I'll show you how those numbers reflected in the multi-tier sewer rate. So on slide 8, it shows, again, this is potable water commodity only, the 3% commodity rate increase and how it was applied to the different tiers. We did not change the tier structure through the cost of service review that we do when we put the budget together. But I would like to point out, if you look at residential tier 1 and residential tier 2, our lowest two tiers, residential tier 1 increased from $1.10 to $1.13, tier 2 from $3.53 to $3.63. Those have a lower percentage increase than the upper tiers, so they're about 2.7%. Bear in mind, most of our customers buy water in those tiers. Tier 3 was $5.84 to $6.01, that's about 3%. And Tier 4 is $11.94 to $12.30, a little over 3%. On the fixed charge, we had a 90-cent increase in the fixed charge for residential potable water. We call this the daily service charge, and so we calculate it on a per-day charge. And you see the daily service charge in January 2020 was 44 cents per day, went up to 46 cents per day. And then the water supply and reliability capital component of that charge went from 13 to 14 cents. So overall, the combined fixed charge, or the what we call the daily rate, went from 57 cents to 60 cents. If you look at that per month, that's a change of about $17.10 to $18. That's how we got the 90 cents. Bear in mind, when you look at our average bill, we'll talk about this in a minute, the fixed charge is about 25 to 26% of a customer's average bill. It's not, and the commodity is about the other two-thirds of it, or the other three-fourths of it. So going on to slide 10, this slide shows, and this was out of the budget presentation, from 2020 to 2021. This is water only, so this was a typical single-family water bill. You know, I do want to point out we use kind of a typical metric, a 15 CCF per month, and you'll see this on the sewer side because it, we also assume a Tier 2 on the sewer when we do our comparisons because that's typically 3 to 4 occupants. And so it's kind of a very average family. So we saw the increase here of $62.99 in 2020. To a water bill for this average customer, residential customer, to $65.20, so about that 3.5% on the water portion. And as I mentioned earlier, if you look at the bottom, that's the capital fee and daily service charge. They make up about 26% of the overall rate, which again allows customers who are having income challenges to be able to really drop their commodity usage and really materially affect their bill because the fixed charge is lower. Now let's shift over to the sewer charges. These were the adopted sewer charges. The board approved a 3.8% annual increase for the daily service charge. As I mentioned earlier, we have a somewhat unique four-tier sewer rate. The current sewer rate at the bottom tier is 56 cents. That went to 58 cents. And at the second tier, 93 cents, 97 cents, and so on for tiers 3 and 4. If you recall, the board put this in place because we were concerned about fixed income, single and double occupant households, particularly some in the more retirement communities in the service area, and their inability, and in fact, as you recall, we did have a customer come one time and said, I'm doing everything I can to save water. I put rocks and cactus in, but my sewer bill, I can't do anything about that. And so we designed this rate structure specifically to accommodate those fixed income residents. So going on to slide 13, this has, puts it all together, water and sewer. And again, we're going to walk through some different levels of consumption. So this is, again, that average customer. When we do that comparison in our budget where we show all the agencies and we line them up, we use this average customer, this 18 CCF of block two sewer customers, 3 to 4 person per household in our typical residential meter. So this graphic shows for this block two sewer customer 2020, the water, sewer, and fixed charges were $102. That would go up to $106, so basically a $4 per month, a little under $4 with the rounding $4 per month increase. Looking at the lower end, and again, those fixed customers, it's somewhat less. So again, that this is a 15 CCF, not an 18 CCF customer. This is that 15 CCF customer that would be, again, a retiree, 1 to 2 persons per household. And so what we see here is this typical bill would go up to from $81 in 2020, and with the rate increase up to about $84, so about $3 per month for these lower fixed income customers. So as I mentioned earlier, one of the things that I understand prompted this discussion was that other agencies, some of our adjacent agencies, have not implemented or deferred rate increases with the goal apparently to help customers that are having income challenges or challenges during the COVID-19 crisis. And I think that that's understandable, but I think what's very important, as I mentioned earlier, is we all serve the same communities. Essentially, we're Southwest Riverside County. We're a number of different agencies, and a customer who may have lost their job in one town that is right across the street from our service area is not any different than the customer who may have lost their job in our service area. So if our goal is to really help with customer affordability, I think it is important to put in the context of how our rates compare to other in the region. So in looking at the special districts around the service area, Eastern shown on the right, that number, again, you see that $106. This is that 18 CCF, the typical customer that we have, sewer block two. And this is the one we use in our larger comparison when we do the 13 agency comparison that we did through the budget process. And it shows that we compare very favorably, even with the rate increase. But I think it's important, this does not include ad valorem property taxes. We do have some information on that as well, so it isn't the total cost to the customer for service. But it does show, certainly relative to Elsinore Valley, they're about $31 per month, or about 29% higher. And Western's about $36 a month, about 34%. Rancho's about $5 per month lower in this scenario. And again, going on to slide 17, and again, this shows our rate increase. This is a graphic you're familiar with from the budget document and from our previous presentations. And you can see where we are at that $106. We're right kind of to the middle right there. Rancho right next to us at that $101. And then you see to the left Elsinore Valley and Western Municipal Water District. Again, we use for this graphic that 18 CCF customer. This is a tier sewer block two 18 CCF customer with an average average water use. So what's also important is to look at total costs and to look at ad valorem property taxes. So we've taken the same information and we have now included the ad valorem property taxes. The way we derived this is we looked at the ad valorem property tax collected by each of the agencies, and then we divided it by the water connections to get an average approximation of that. So again, when you add ours on, it's another $21. Again, this is a fixed charge. This includes with our rate adjustment and our current ad valorem property taxes, so it's $127. You see Elsinore Valley is about $28 higher in this case, Rancho about $52 per month higher, and Western about $87 per month higher. So when you include the property taxes, it does make a difference. And again, it shows we're very competitive with our other agencies, and we are providing good value to the customer. In the 15 CCF scenario, again, this excludes the property taxes, but looks at that comparison using the lower use, the 15 CCF, the 5-inch, you know, the average meter, 5-inch or 3/4-inch meter, and the sewer block one. So this would be the two-person household, lower consumption. Again, we're about $84 with the proposed rate increase. Elsinore at about $99, Rancho at about $115, and Western about $139. One of the things that's very important I want to point out is what are those differences? And I think under our rate structure, particularly under sewer, if you have one to two people per household, if you can see on in a director record on slide 19, the sewer charge is about $22. And again, it gets ratioed down because we have those tier sewers. Plus, our fixed charges are $18. And so they're lower as well. So the blue bar in the middle, if you look at the comparison of the fixed charge, we're $18. The others range from 29 to 42 on those fixed charges. And again, I think this is important because we've always structured our rates such that we are very commodity heavy on the revenue side of the rates. So it gives the customers who have income challenges the ability to be able to regulate their water use and really self-regulate their water bills much more effectively. And again, similarly, when you add on the ad valorem property taxes, they're still very competitive. Elsinore about $28 per month higher, Rancho about $72, and Western about $106. And so this is on page 20. And when you look at those numbers and you look at them on an annualized basis, they're fairly significant. They're tangible. And so I think it's important to realize that we are providing a service, even with the proposed rate increase, that's less expensive than the other agencies. So the Proposition 218 results, just as a reminder on that process, as you recall, we went out and on May 2019, and direct record, I'm on slide 22, we mailed Proposition 218 notices to 222,745 property owners. One of the things, Director Pauly, you recall, you said that we should mail out multiple notices, other letting know about the hearing. We did a lot of website. We did a lot of social media on it. We really tried to get people to attend the public hearing. Again, you can say, well, that was before COVID, and so maybe you'd get a different response now. But again, we received 18 written protests. That's 0.008% of property owners. Six district customers attended the hearing. Even if we had 100 times that now, you're still going to be below a 1% protest. So again, we're not seeing customers calling in and saying the rates are too high or they're unaffordable. We're having customers basically listen to the governor's executive order, not pay their bills, or getting behind in significant amounts. And I want to talk about how we think it's more sensible to approach that and how we have approached that to help our customers. So under other considerations, and this starts on slide 24, one of the things that I think we need to bear in mind is there's a lot of uncertainty associated with COVID-19, the governor's executive order, and potential legislative actions. Bear in mind, we are under an executive order since April 2020 from Governor Newsom, where the district is required to continue to provide service with non-payment. So we have to provide service to customers with non-payment. We do not have the ability to shut customer services down. And I will tell you, it's kind of interesting. We receive, a customer will give a report, and they say we've had our account shut off. That goes to the state. The state will notify us that you had a customer that you shut down, and we need to provide the information. We've had that happen a couple of times. We find it's usually an error, and we clear it up with the state. But the state is watching. It's actually a little bit scary. But we need to continue to provide that payment with non-payment. I think the pandemic severity we've seen certainly increase in this quarter, in the second quarter. It's unclear how long the executive order will end. or when it will end, or how it's going to get out of it, and particularly how is the legislature going to resolve customer debt issues. We have a legislature that is very favorable to providing assistance. There's some speculation we're hearing that the state could require special districts with rate-making capability to absorb this customer debt and use reserves. And that's not too far-fetched. If you think about in the past, the legislature, the Little Hoover Commission, others have really targeted our reserves and special district reserves. And this even goes back to the 80s and 90s when the state did ERAF shifts, Educational Reform Augmentation Fund, where they took a portion of our property taxes, again, because we had rate-making capability. So I think those types of solutions are not necessarily far-fetched. And, again, we need to hedge against those potentially. We also had an election yesterday that basically swung Congress. There could be financial implications of that. Typically, there is when you have one party running the federal government at all levels, you do have economic challenges that go with that, and that's history has shown that. So I'm not saying that is going to happen, but it's something certainly we need to hedge against. Under slide 25, there's other financial considerations when we've thought about this late deferral. We had a great, first quarter report. It found that although we were certainly having some challenges from customer delinquencies, that in general the district's financial health was positive and good. But we are seeing, you know, of course, the pandemic surge in the second quarter impacting jobs, et cetera. We anticipate really those restrictions to continue for the foreseeable future. You know, we've talked about a vaccine, the pandemic riding down. I don't think anybody can give us a date when that's going to be over and things are going to go back to normal. And I think more notably, in between November and December, we did see a significant jump in the 61-plus day aging. So in early November, we were at about 18% on 61-plus day aging. We saw that really jump up in late December to over 20%, and our accounts receivable for 60-day-plus are about $4.3 million. So, you know, I think the rate increase, which would generate annually about $4.3 million and over the next 6 months about $4.15 million, really will help us cover any actual inflationary expenses that are included in our budget, as well as hedge our risk to some extent, because we really don't know when the end of this will occur. I think another consideration that we looked at is if we were to defer the rate increase, is it going to have a real tangible benefit to customers? Is it going to do that? And if you look at it, we're talking about something that's, you know, about $3 to $4 per month. Typical, our customers who are having struggles are not paying their bills. They're more than 2 months behind on those bills, and they're $200 behind on the bills. So, again, deferring a rate increase of $3 a month is not going to necessarily pull a customer with a 61-plus day aging account of over $200 back in where they are now paying their water bills. And we do have programs, and our recommendations, let's focus on those programs that have a real tangible benefit and can really help our customers. And I think the last point on this is, to the extent we do defer rates, it will certainly require a catch-up rate increase in the future. When we would do that, the potential economic impacts of that time and the magnitude of that rate increase are unknown. But again, if you do have inflationary expenses, at some point, the piper needs to be paid, and we will need to adjust the rates accordingly. So on slide 26, we do have, as I mentioned, very robust programs to help the customers. We're trying to push those out. That's really what we're emphasizing right now. The Help to Others program with the $100 bill of credit, that's a tangible program that will help customers. The board's last action to waive the late fees, those were $25 a month for the wait fees. That's a significant improvement. The payment plans have been very effective. We continue to have customers go on payment plans, and the interest-free payment plans have been very helpful. And, of course, we finally have sorted out with the county the Community Action Partnership for the CARES Act funding, the initial tranche of that, where they have the $3 million available. Oh, and I'm sorry, I didn't change that. Oops. there we go, excuse me, $3 million available for that program, and they need to deploy that by March, so we're coordinating with them to get our many of our customers in that as possible. As I mentioned earlier and in my report, the COVID relief package signed by the president on the 27th does contain some funding, which we think is very positive. We will need to work out how we can get that funding, whether it's through the county or whether we can get that directly. And, of course, we would be going after that available grant funding. And, again, if you look, we have some very tangible, very material, and good programs that are significant enough to help our customers, particularly those customers that are having difficulty paying their bills. So just kind of in short to summarize, I think we would recommend continue the implementation of the board-approved rate increase that was effective January 1st. It matches those inflationary costs that we've included in the budget. It hedges against what I think is some fairly substantial alternative or uncertainty. The not implementing the rate increase or that difference is not going to, in our minds, really help struggling customers. The other programs will, and that rescinding the rate and deferring it is going to require a future catch-up rate increase. I do want to remind the board, right around the corner, in February, we will be starting our next biennial budget and rate process, so we will be able to get into those rates and look forward to that discussion, so we do have the ability to look at those fairly quickly here. And again, I think our second recommendation is we need to go full bore on these active deployment of the board-approved customer service assistance and rate relief programs. These will provide really tangible help. We want to promote these, and we are doing a lot of promotion of these right now, but really try to get those customers in them and then complement that with going after this available federal funding. So with that, at this point, we have time for discussion and questions. Jeff, Joe, myself, Nick, Laura, we all helped put this together. And so if you have questions and want to direct those questions, we'd be happy to answer those and receive some direction from the board on how it would like to proceed at this point.
First, thank you for that very thorough presentation, Mr. Jones. With that, I would open up for board discussion. I recognize Mr. Armstrong. And first, I want to thank Mr. Armstrong, Director Armstrong, for bringing this to our attention. I think it facilitated a very thoughtful and good discussion. So thank you for bringing this up. And the floor is yours.
Okay, thanks. And I also want to thank staff for the presentation, too. And I did want to kind of clarify one comment that was made. I didn't bring this up because other agencies had deferred rate increases. I brought this up because of the effects of the pandemic on our communities that we serve. And while the Prop 218 notice didn't generate a lot of response to Eastern, during my campaign, I had a lot more response, phone calls, emails, messages about rates and the impacts on customers. And so I've heard it directly from, at least from the community that I represent. That's the reason why I wanted to bring it up, not because other agencies were doing this. But I think these are unprecedented times. This isn't normal times. And I think in normal times, everything that the staff presented makes a lot of sense. And I certainly agree with and stand behind the fiscal responsibility of an organization. But these are very different times. People are unemployed. Businesses are closing. Small businesses are closing. People are struggling, and things are getting worse right now. They're worse today than they were 3 or 4 weeks ago when I brought this up. I recognize that some customers are not paying their bills, but there are a lot of customers that are paying their bills, and not everybody that pays their bill is not struggling. There's a lot of people that pay their bills, honor their debts, that are struggling through this, but are making do. And so, I think the strength of Eastern is the strength of its community, including the financial strength of its community. That's what really supports Eastern Municipal Water District, and you have to look out for them in unprecedented times. I know there's nobody in this room that would want to put more pressure on customers during this, and yet you still have to run a business. It's not the magnitude of the increase that's the problem. It's not. I agree that this is a very nominal rate increase, But every little tiny bit can have an impact. And that was when I said the straw that breaks the camel's back. The straw is a very light, tiny straw. This is bigger than a straw. But the straw that breaks the camel's back, it's just a little bit that pushes people over. And you need to think about that in these unprecedented times. The chart that you showed comparing the different agencies, I think one of the things that it does show is that, or that you mentioned, is that the other agencies right around us, the three that you mentioned, did defer their rate increase or rescinded or didn't implement one. And other agencies throughout the county and Southern California have done the same thing. So it shows it can be done. And I can't believe others can do it, and we couldn't do it if we wanted to. But I also think that comparing monthly bills is not really the whole picture. And Eastern is... I'm sorry. Oh, I thought you were saying... Never mind. Oh, okay. It's not the whole picture. And Eastern has been very at the front of bill affordability. I would say the demographics of different districts is different than Eastern's district. You can have the lowest bill here, but it could be a bigger impact on somebody's disposable income than a slightly larger bill in a different agency. So I think bill affordability is really the thing to look at, not the exact amount of the monthly water bill. I also, when I did some of my own research on the budget, so maybe I learned something today that I had wrong, but it looked like when rates were set, the metropolitan water rate increase that was projected and built into these rates was 4%. That's what I saw from the reports, but maybe it wasn't. So I learned that, but I thought it was. So that was one of the reasons why I thought this was a doable proposition. But the other thing that I learned was, went through some of this, was that fiscal year 2020, you talked about that, the net operating margin budgeted was $57 million, but actually was $84 million in actual. So it's a $27 million great net operating margin for the year ended June 2020 than was budgeted. So when you think about that and you think about having over $500 million in reserves that really belongs to the public and are there for emergencies and for tough times, you certainly have the wherewithal to weather a year like this. And you also have the wherewithal to ensure that you come out of this and when you have to address the next year and the next year, you have reserves to help you smooth out of that and not have 10% or 15% rate increases. You have the ability to do that. So I think we have all the tools and the ability to do this. And, I mean, staff did a good job of presenting all the reasons why we shouldn't. But, I mean, these are times to really think about, other than normal business, what we need to do to help our community and stay strong for our community and look out for our community. So those are my comments.
Very good.
I have a question. Lawson. When you're comparing the water commodity charges with other agencies, those agencies that I know some put more on the monthly, the fixed fee, but the agencies that charge less on the actual commodity charge, are those typically, do they typically have the same amount of water that they get from Met that they import?
No, and that's going to vary by agency, the ratio of groundwater to imported water to desalted water. I mean, so we all have different portions of and different supplies that end up driving that. But again, the way they recover those costs are through both commodity and fixed charges. We've just chosen to have our commodity charges basically be more significant and our fixed charges be lower to allow customers flexibility to be able to do that. But yes, part of that and part of that may be driven by their sources of water.
Okay.
Did that answer your question,
yeah,
Director
Slauson? Yeah, it does.
If I could add to that.
I think we've done a good job with the outreach of the resources available to our customers to help with their payments. I was really happy when we basically waived the late charges. That's a huge savings for those that specifically are targeted for those who are struggling. Those, you know, we have 70% of the our customer base is still on time, and as you mentioned, Director Armstrong, That doesn't mean that's not significant to them, but I would just sort of say there's some probably decent percentage of that 70% that don't have a problem paying with it. And those customers, they could probably care less. That's why a huge amount of people do not react to our Prop 218 notices. I would end up by saying, I think deferring what we know is necessary, that combined with other questions about the pandemic, what's going to happen, and if OPEBs that we're trying to cover throughout the years, if we don't kind of keep up, then it's going to snowball. And I forget specifically the year, but I do remember probably soon after I was elected here, so it was probably late 90s or something, that the district had not increased rates in 10 years or so because they were under pressure not to increase rates. And I guess we were in a bit of a recession in the early 90s. And they did like a, I don't know what it was, 15% increase. And then that did hurt. And, you know, even those who have disposable income, it's still a hit to try to absorb that. So I just don't think that's the prudent way to proceed, my personal opinion. And I don't think this is a substantial increase. So I don't think, by and large, it will affect many people. And yes, if we're continuing to promote the resources and other resources available to help them, and as far as we know, like the presentation, we don't know what's going to happen with these late payments and lack of turnoffs. We may just be required to absorb that, which would be a big windfall for all of our customers, especially those who haven't been making the payments. And we need to be in a position to be able to do that. So I support the increase.
I had a question about the how the you talked about the ad valorem taxes. Can somebody tell me how you calculated that on an individual?
Yeah, I'll start, and then maybe somebody can fill in. We took it the total ad valorem taxes being charged by each agency and divided it by the number of potable water accounts to get kind of an average.
So that's not really accurate then, because you have a certain amount of residential properties out in Rancho. For example, the entire district is charged, whether you're ag or whether you're commercial or whatever. If you're going to do it, you would have to take all the residential accounts and just only do the residential accounts. The ag accounts, they'll be charged based on the $30 on every $100 of value of the land only. So the amount of money that's coming in from the ag accounts is going to be much, much lower than it is for a residential account, or say like the mall.
So the those mall could actually be higher in some cases.
So the residential, so your subsidized, I mean your figures to me would seem that all the other properties would be added into and make a much higher ad valorem amount. So okay, so let's say you've got 100 residents, you've got 100 residents, and you've got all these ag accounts, you've got all these other guys, and you've got $1 million worth of ad valorem tax that comes in. So you're going to take 100 million, you divide it by 3, and say okay, all that is the property tax for this average homeowner. No, it doesn't work that way. If it was going to be proper, it would seem to me that you would take all the ad valorem tax that was attributed to residential, and then you would do that calculation and not include, you know, the other 70% of Rancho that is paid separately and at a different rate, because everyone gets charged based on the at least in Rancho, the county's assessed valuation of the land. So, I mean, I'm just asking if that's how you did it, or what, but I, I, it seemed to me that that number was a little high. So, and the other comment I have is that, you know, you mentioned, okay, there are certain people that aren't paying right now, and you've got the people that are paying. So I don't think that, okay, if we put the rate further up, and I did vote against this back when it happened, we put the rate up, then the same people who are paying the rate now are going to be the ones paying the rate and paying the higher rate, and the people that aren't paying, and I think you mentioned it at our last meeting, it potentially that they will be excused from that. And so the people that are actually paying are the ones that are going to get punished on this. And they're the ones that are going to have to pay the higher rate. The people that aren't paying right now are maybe excused and won't have to pay it at all. So I think Jeff's right when he talks about, you know, the straw that breaks the camel's back. If you you paid your bill, and then you find out that, oh, they're going to get excused. They didn't pay their bill. They're going to get excused. Then that guy's going to say, why should I pay my bill? You know, I'm getting hammered here because I actually pay my bill, and the guy that doesn't pay his bill, he's going to get off. So, I mean, for the guy that pays his bill, I think, you know, hey, throw him a bone and give him a little more time or reduce, not reduce the rate, but keep the rate the same for, you know, a short period of time until, you know, we're in better times. But like, you know, the district has the money. You know, I know it could snowball. It could snowball. And the example that Dave gave, you know, that can happen. That can happen. But I sincerely doubt that this district would go 10 years without, go 10 years without raising rates. And I think this is just merely we're going to delay a little bit. And I don't have that much of a problem with it.
Can I address a couple of the comments that have been made?
Certainly,
so far?
Certainly. We're helpful. Having a discussion. So absolutely.
One thing you mentioned, Director Corona, is that bills would be excused. Today, the governor's executive order has been very clear that they can defer payment, but ultimately they owe the amount due. Now, could that change in the future? Certainly, but I just want to say we are not excusing customers' bills. Customers still have to pay the bills, except for the ones who take advantage of the low-income program, as you know. I think, secondly, Director Armstrong, you mentioned something about bill affordability, and is our bills affordable relative to our customer base? I think the point you might have been making, if I have it right, is that because we have a lower, perhaps, income in our service area, that to compare us to another agency that has higher incomes, it's not necessarily an appropriate comparison. I do want to point out that, as the board knows, we had UC Riverside do a very extensive study of water rate affordability in Eastern Service Area. And because of several factors, our budget-based rate structure, our low fixed charge, the ability for customers to self-regulate, and again, this looked at 20 years of billing records, and looked at metrics that and benchmarks by US EPA and others, our affordability is, we have a very, very high level of affordability in the service area. Very, very low percentage of customers struggle paying with their water bills based on any of those metrics. So I understand your argument, but I just want to reassure you, we don't have a situation that even with our $105 bill, we're having substantial, you know, affordability challenges on a kind of systemic basis. On the comment regarding the operating margin, yes, we did have a more robust operating margin last year, but bear in mind that margin goes to pay for capital projects. Essentially, that's debt that we don't have to issue if we can apply that directly to the capital projects. And the reserves, yes, they are at the amount that you mentioned, but they're not arbitrary. Those are capital funds. We have an extremely robust capital program, and the vast majority of those reserves and those reserve accounts are attributed to bond proceeds, connection fees, and other things that are going to go right out the door to pay for those capital projects. So And we can go through with the breakdown of those reserves. So we do have fairly substantial reserves, but we also have a very, very active capital program. Just want to clarify those.
And I don't dispute that you should have reserves and that you need the reserves that comply with your policy, whatever that policy is, and you should build those reserves and you should have a plan to build those reserves, but those are also here for times of use. And I just think this is one of those times. So that was my point about the reserve. This is one of those times to consider that. So
Director Record.
Yeah, thank you, President Pauly. Good presentation, good discussion. Nobody wants to raise rates. I mean, it's not fun. But being responsible for the district's long-term health is our job. When I look at the presentation and consider everything that's involved, I'm very pleased with what we've done over the years because we're not just responding to whatever's going on in a particular year. We've made a conscious effort to make sure that people get rewarded for conservation and make sure that people that probably least afford to pay a high water bill have the opportunity to use less water and pay less money. And that gets us through times like these, and I'm very proud of that. And we're an entity that hasn't relied on fixed charges as much as others. That's obvious here. And so we have to comply or adapt to whatever's going on. So we're on a really good path. I am amazed at everything we've been able to do as far as utilizing all our recycled water, providing groundwater desalinization, good groundwater recharge, a whole number of things, and still the rates are so competitive with the others in the region, and they all have their challenges, and I'm not being critical. I'm just saying that what we do and how we give the ability for our ratepayers to not have a big water bill gets us through times like these. And so we sympathize with everything that's going on. It's pretty scary out there, and who knows how long this is going to last. But I do think that we're on the right track, and I think that the rate increase was appropriate, and I think what you showed us today points that out. I would also like to remind people that at Metropolitan, we're not currently collecting the rate stabilization or the demand management money that we need for conservation and to fund local projects. We're fast going through the reserves, and when we reach a point where we're going to have to deal with that, there's something that's going to have to be added to the MET's rate structure. It will ultimately end up impacting member agencies' rates. We also have, hopefully, at some point, a Delta infrastructure that is really needed for long-term safety and reliability that we're going to have to pay for. So, as I said, I certainly understand what people are going through. I think that we've provided a lot of programs that will help people weather through this, and I think we should concentrate on the next cycle and continue to look at ways that we can be very helpful to all of our ratepayers and continue to provide quality water at a reasonable rate, which has never been more important than it is in the times that we're in right now.
Thank you, Director Record. Let me chime in for a moment. Again, I appreciate the discussion. I think it's a good one, and it was great to hear the review of where we're at financially and what we have done. I'm very proud of the fact that we have come up with some programs. As Director Armstrong points out, we are in unprecedented times. I mean, when we have policies that are hurting small business, that is unprecedented times. We have the federal government basically doing reverse income taxes and sending people money. That's unprecedented times. And I think we have addressed it here at Eastern with the rate assistance programs. And we're not talking here about a rate increase. We're talking about a deferral of the rate. So let me ask just a practical question of staff here. if we were to go down the path, and I let's just say for 6 months we deferred this, what are the real dollars and cents we're talking about? Do we have a figure if we actually did not?
$4.15 million for 6 months. It's in the presentation.
Okay,
about $8.3 million.
So what is it again?
The rate increase raises about $8.3 million.
So we're talking about an $8.3 million deferral.
For a year, and half of that for 6 months.
Okay, so right around $4 million deferral.
Is that correct, Laura?
Okay. Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Okay. Oh, sure. Sure.
Maybe it's time we had another, you know, presentation discussion on where our reserves are and where you know what are the unrestricted, what are the restricted reserves, and what they can be used for. One of the things that just kind of comes to mind is if we felt we had reserves that were available for any purpose, we could have paid off our OPEB, but we didn't. We could have paid down some of the hundreds of millions of debt we have, but we didn't. We haven't, because we felt those reserves were necessary for us to function properly. So, I'm not so sure, unless there's something that's occurred, maybe it would be timely for us to have an update on our reserves.
Well, we are going to be bringing back a review of the reserve policy in...
either February or March.
Yeah, February or March. I mean, that's what the current schedule was. We're relooking at the reserve policy, updating it, bringing it back, and, you know, but we can bring information before that if you think it would be helpful.
And also as part of the budget, we look at reserves.
Yeah. Okay.
But we can get into the reserve categories, what they are, what they're used for, et cetera.
So one of my thoughts, again, because we do want to address affordability issues, and I think we do have programs in place, is would it be possible, do we have some bandwidth to redouble our efforts of communicating all the programs we have in place for those people right now that may find themselves in some financial difficulties?
Yes, and we've actually done direct mail. We're doing direct mailings. We've also really ramped up the social media, the websites, and the outreach on that, and have been wanting to do that to make sure our customers know that they can avail themselves of the program. And then the other part of it, again, as I mentioned, was that community action program on behalf of the county. They finally got that kind of up and running through some good work that our staff did with the county. That's going to be available. It has to be deployed by March, so we want to try to get as many customers in that, and then if there's federal funding coming to replenish that program, be able to do that as well.
So let me ask, and I see Charles here, and Charles, if I could impose on you, let me ask you this. If a customer called in tomorrow and said, I saw my rate went up a little bit, I'm really having a problem paying right now, what would the response be from our customer service team?
Well, we would offer up the...
Come up to the microphone if you don't mind.
Good morning. Yeah, so we would offer up the assistance programs that we've been talking about, and quite recently the new program, the CAP program, that's really a big talking point for our customer service advisors as we communicate with the customers. In addition to that, we would offer up payment arrangements, the payment plans. Should a customer ask the driver behind the increase, we have really good talking points from our public and government affairs that all the customer service advisors have, and we walk them through to understand what that increase goes to. So that's how I would respond to that question, sir.
So could you do me, and I think the board of favor, because again, I want to address Director Armstrong, and the board does have interaction with our communities.
Yep.
I would love to have that, and I don't know if the other directors would, in my back pocket, kind of a synopsis of, if I ever got approached by a customer, I'm having a hard time, could we make sure that we have the information so we can send them to you or the right people and maybe explain a little more about what our programs are?
Absolutely. Okay. I'll get that pulled together.
I'd appreciate if we could get that information in a easy to understand and read packet to the board.
Sure.
So.
Yep.
Charles, can I ask you a question too?
Yes, sir.
So I know there's a discussion about, you know, $4 million or somewhere around there of delinquent charges right now. What do we do to try to ensure that we will collect on those $4 million and not write them off? Do we do things like place real property liens on properties, do tax liens? What do we do?
Yeah, so currently we do process liens on properties. We've been looking at property taxes as well as the intercept program through income tax. So those are all options that we're looking at that we'll be bringing back to the board for approval to move forward with those programs.
Okay.
Yep.
So, but we haven't done...
No, the lien...
The lien is currently in place, yeah. Yes.
Okay.
We will lien properties.
Yes, and we have been doing that. Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
It does go a long way to, I mean, it's a cash flow issue. You wait, but it goes a long way to protect yourself.
Agreed. Yeah. Agreed.
And then, President Pauley, I have one follow-up question from your comment. You asked about the amount of reserves for 6 months, and it was that we would need to use. It was $4.1 or $4.5 million, but it's half of what it would be for the whole year, essentially.
Correct. $8 million for the year, $8.3 million.
Yeah, so I don't know if you just split it in half, but you're really going into winter, where consumption would not be as great as it is in summertime. So I would assume that amount would be probably less, not the full, not half, but something quite a bit less, because the demand isn't as high, which would kind of help the district if we were to do this, because the demand isn't so great during that period of time.
Have we heard anything from Edison or Gas or Met or the chemical providers that they're going to absorb any increases, or we expect?
No, they're not.
Well, I think I gave you the information on the Met increase, and what
okay, that was rhetorical. That was rhetorical. I know, but yeah, it's just not as easy as we would like, and it is unfortunate. But
yeah, I just like to say it's a difficult decision. Riverside Public Utilities put together a 5-year rate plan, and they had to make the difficult decision whether they were going to proceed with it. And they had to have deliberations like this to make that call. But they understood their programs, and their CIP was really critical, so they moved ahead with their rate increase. It's a difficult decision, I know.
Yeah, some of our CIP programs are very – well, all of them are very important for her.
As are our bond ratings.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things when we go before the rating agencies that they have pointed out to is our and the board's political will to continue to increase rates when expenses go up. And that, plus our strong cash position and cash on hand, plus a number of different metrics have resulted in our AAA rating. So, you know, again, I think we have a very good track record of fiscal responsibility. And, you know, from staff's perspective, that is a very important consideration.
And when you talk about your credit rating, I agree with you. You don't want to get into 10%, 15%, you know, rate increases and delay it for year after year after year. But I've sat through the credit rating presentations even just a few months ago and talked about deferring rates and not raising rates and due to the pandemic. And it's a triple A credit agency, and it's not a problem. You know, you do something like this one time, you go through crisis, you go through the housing crisis, the financial crisis, the drought, you go through these things and you have a plan. You're still a strong AAA credit, and one action like this to help out right now, it's not going to hurt your credit at all.
Mr. President, I got a question. Is what we have a situation here, is it strictly an informational item, or is there, you know, can we do something about this?
I mean, well, the board would need to give direction. If you wanted to move forward with this, you have a lot of options. A, you don't have to do anything. B, you could put this on a following board meeting in which we would have the rate resolutions and all the documentation, rates and charges and budget adjustments before the board to do that. Could defer it to a committee. You have a number of different options.
I would like to do that and at least put it out for a vote and see how it goes. I would make a motion to put it to the next board meeting, and then we would vote on that here, whether it got enough
well,
votes
it,
or it
under the administrative
votes.
Code and legal counsel, you can chime in on this. If two board members direct an item to be put on the agenda, can be put on the agenda for a future meeting.
Okay, I'd like to make a motion.
That's
go ahead.
Steve, sorry, I was playing lawyer there.
Paul Jones,
that's
Esquire.
Correct. Our administrative code addresses how directors can put matters on the agenda, on future agendas, and you'll notice that, of course, our agenda does have a section for future agenda items, and the code says that a director can have something agendized for a future meeting with the concurrence of one other director. Director Corona, I believe, was speaking. So, Director Corona, if you'd like to have this considered under a future agenda item, you can do so with the concurrence of another board member. We're not at the future agenda section of the agenda now, but with the chair's permission, you could do that now with the concurrence of another director.
I would certainly entertain if we wanted to go down that road to do it now, but I want to be very specific of what we're putting on the agenda for an action item, not just a, this has been a great discussion, but if we could make a specific.
Okay. So I would propose that we put on the agenda a deferral of the increase in the rates, fees, and charges for a 6-month period.
For a 6-month period, could we name when we're starting?
Starting from the date that we approve it.
Okay.
I'll second that.
Can I clarify that? Would this be deferred until July 1, 2021?
Yes.
Because they were effective January 1st, 2021.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
So, Director Armstrong, you're concurring on that, correct?
Correct.
So let me ask legal counsel then, with given our admin policy, what we're going to have is for the January 20th, I believe, board meeting, we would have an action item on the agenda to defer the rate increase from January 1st to July 1st, 2021. That's what Director Corona has asked for, correct?
Correct. And it's my understanding also that there'd have to be some we'd have to do some new resolutions to affect that, as well as I believe General Manager Jones, a budget alteration, or the budget must be addressed as well?
We'll look at the budget, and then we would do a rate resolution and a new schedule of rates and charges.
Okay.
Got it. Okay.
So that now will be on the January 20th, 2021 agenda as an action item. Is that my understanding, Mr. Counsel?
That's, yes.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Any further discussion on this item? Seeing none, why don't we take a 10-minute break?
Thank you.
Thank you. We did all the engineering.
We could, if we could start to reconvene. Madam Clerk, we could make sure that General Counsel and Director Record are back on the line with us.
Director Record?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, very good. All right, that will take us to informational item B, which is the Winchester Water and Sewer Facilities Evaluation. Good morning.
Good morning. Can everybody hear me okay?
I think we can.
Okay. Thank you for the opportunity to provide an update on the Winchester Water and Sewer Evaluation. The agenda today, the topics covered include background on the project, the proposed land use amendment for the area, the impact the proposed land use has on sewer flow projections, water demand projections, and the water and sewer master plan facilities. I'll also discuss the coordination efforts with the Winchester MAC stakeholder group and present the next steps for the project. The proposed land use amendment for the Winchester Community Plan encompasses an area of approximately 23,000 acres in the district service area. As noted on the map, the Winchester Community Plan area lies within the central portion of the district service area. The land use amendment for this area was adopted by Riverside County Planning Commission in 2016. Since then, a subsequent land use amendment was proposed in 2019, which modified the 2016 adopted amendment. The district's master plans were completed in 2015 prior to the 2016 land use amendment. Thus, the district's master plans did not consider either the adopted 2016 land use amendment or the proposed 2019 amendment. So the current study underway evaluated the change in land use from the master plans to the proposed 2019 land use amendment. Thus, both land use amendments have been captured within the current study. So this graphic shows the land use plan for the 2019 amendment. The extent of the area is bounded by Briggs Road on the west, Scott Road to the south, and California Avenue and Stetson Avenue at the top of the graph are the east and north boundaries. The yellow areas indicate residential land uses. The pink areas denote business park. You'll see that a good portion of the northeast corner changed land use to business park. The purple area adjacent to the pink area is mixed land use. There's primarily two significant changes that we saw from the 2016 to the 2019 amendment, and that was in the northeast corner where there's the business park designation, as well as the southern area. There's a significant change from low-density residential to medium-density residential. So within the master plan, because it was a low-density residential, we would assume that that would area would have been on a septic system. This slide shows the summary changes to the land use specific to the water system. Next slide, we'll get into the changes in land use for the sewer system. But a couple of comments on the water system graphic. The green areas represent the same land use that was used for the master plans. Thus, there was no impact to water demands or infrastructure in the green areas on this map. So the changes from the master plan are reflected in the pink and the blue areas. Pink is a change from the master plan land use assumption. Mostly this change represented an increase in EDUs and thus water demands. The blue area represents areas that were added to the water system, meaning that in the master plan, the land use within one of these blue areas was not planned to be connected to the water system. So in categories such as open land or open space land use would represent one of the blue areas of the change of land use. You will notice that there are a lot of not too many blue areas on the water system graphic. The sewer system, when we get to the next slide, you'll notice there's a lot of changes that are denoted by the blue areas on the map. But the combined impact of the adopted 2016 land use amendment and the proposed 2019 land use amendment is the addition of more than 9,000 EDUs to the water system, which increased the water demand by approximately 4 million gallons per day. So we shift to the impact on the sewer system. You can tell distinct differences between the water and the sewer systems here. This specific slide is pertinent to the sewer system. So similar to the last slide, the green areas on the map represent areas where there's the master plan and the proposed land use amendment are the same, so in effect, no change. The differences in the land use map from the master plan are reflected again in the pink and the blue areas. And as you'll notice on the sewer map, as compared to the water map, there's a lot more blue areas. The blue areas on this on the sewer map were assumed to be on septic system for the master plan, so thus not connected to the district's collection system. Typically, those land use categories would have been like low density, very low density, or rural residential designation. So the proposed land use amendment changed residential use to MDR, specifically in the southern area. That's why you see that big block of blue. And then because it's been redesignated to medium-density residential, we would then assume that Eastern would be responsible for providing sewer collection system to them. In the northern area, again, you'll see the significant change. Again, that was from a designation we would have assumed was on septic because it was rezoned to business park. Again, we're assuming with the land use amendment that we would have to provide sewer service up to those areas. So the impact of the land use amendments on the sewer system resulted in more than 16,500 EDUs connected to the sewer system, which also increased flow by about 4 MGD. So how did the increase in water and water demands affect the water facilities master plan? So on the water system, the impact is actually fairly minimal. There's a slight increase in storage needs in Paris Valley service area in the 1720 Winchester Hills pressure zone of about 0.2 million gallons. In the San Jacinto Valley service area, storage needs increased by about 1.8 million gallons in the 1719 pressure zone. There are also some very minor pipeline improvements that are needed due to the change in land use. This is due to some of the very large transmission mains that are planned for the future through this area. So as you recall from the November board meeting when we presented EM11 pipeline alignment study, those large diameter transmission mains basically are routed right through the Winchester Community Plan. So the EM11 transmission system will be able to convey up to 140 CFS, which is approximately 100 MGD. So an increase of 4 MGD on the water system compared to that is fairly minor, which explains why we're not seeing a lot of the impact on the water system to the planned facilities. And when we switch to the collection system, there actually are some significant impacts on the sewer system. There's quite a number of pipelines and lift stations that are affected by the proposed land use change in the Winchester Community Plan area. So all the pipelines circled on this map are the sewer facilities that need to be larger to accommodate the proposed change in land use and subsequent flow increase. As highlighted in the text, most of the pipelines in the circled area need to be increased by one pipeline size to accommodate the additional sewer flow. So, for example, a 12-inch would need to be increased to a 15-inch. There are a couple examples where larger pipeline increases would be needed, but in general, it was typically one pipe size increase on the sewer system. So for the lift stations, there are two existing lift stations within the Winchester Community Plan area and three future planned lift stations. For the existing lift stations, the impact of Winchester lift station is that the projected build-out flows increase from 14.6 million gallons per day to 17.9 million gallons per day. The impact to the Sun City lift station is negligible. The existing Sun City lift station can handle the increase in flows projected based on the land use change. So for the future lift stations, Wickard Road lift station is projected to increase from 0.3 MGD to 0.5 MGD. And then the largest impact to the lift stations are the future Menifee Road and Southeast lift stations. As you can see from the slide, the Menifee Road lift station doubles its required pumping capacity, and the Southeast lift station has more than a tenfold increase in required pumping capacity. The substantial increase in pumping capacity at the Southeast lift station is due to the master plan assuming that much of this tributary area to the lift station would remain on septic. With the land use change to medium density residential in the area, it will need to be sewered, which is why there's such a large increase in the projected flows to the Southeast lift station. We did hold a coordination meeting with the Winchester MAC stakeholders group on September 22nd. They are currently reviewing the information presented and will provide comments back to the district for incorporation into the final report of the document. The next steps for the project include incorporating feedback from Winchester MAC stakeholder group, preparing the financial impacts of the proposed land use amendment to the water and sewer master plan build-out facilities, and then preparation of the report documents. Thank you for the opportunity to present this item, and are there any questions or comments?
Any questions regarding this? I'd just like to say thank you for the presentation. I do hope at some point when the Winchester MAC reconvenes into in-person meetings that we can do a presentation, either this or similar to them, to give the whole community an update on what we're doing. It is probably the next large area of growth in our service area, and it is important that we're keeping up on the infrastructure and informing the community. So I appreciate the presentation.
Thank you, Director Pulley.
Thank you so much. With that, we will go to item 6C, which is an informational item on the Paris Valley Pipeline. Mr. Mawad, good morning.
Good morning again, Mr. President, members of the board. Mm-hmm. Wanted to provide you with a brief update on our ongoing coordination with Metropolitan to advance completion of the Paris Valley Pipeline. As you're aware, completion of this facility will provide us with significant additional imported water supplies to the district. As you may recall, back in 2004, both us and Western requested additional deliveries from Metropolitan's Mills filtration plant. At the time, we were experiencing, the entire region was experiencing rapid growth. We requested additional 200 cubic feet per second from Mills, and Metropolitan and Western requested additional 55 CFS. Based on our joint request, Metropolitan advanced the design of the Paris Valley Pipeline, and that was initiated in 2005. During the period of 2006 through 2008, multiple construction contracts were advanced by Metropolitan to essentially construct what is an 8-foot diameter transmission system that extends 6.5 miles. There was a contract for the piping at the Mills plant. There's a northern reach, which I'll share some additional details as far as the alignment and the configuration of the pipeline. And there's also a southern reach that is 3.5 miles. Moving on to slide 3 gives you a perspective on the overall alignment of the Paris Valley Pipeline. As I mentioned, it commences at the Mills plant, and then there's a northern reach up to Cactus Avenue. That reach has been not only completed, but it's been put in service. In 2006, we also completed our Cactus booster station, as well as a Cactus feeder that feeds Moreno Valley. The southern reach that you see there in the lighter blue was completed with the exception of the Interstate 215 crossing, and I'll get into the specifics of why that was omitted from the construction contract. That reach, which again stretches 3.5 miles, was completed but was not placed in service. At the terminus of the southern reach, we have acquired property to construct our Western Way booster station to provide additional supplies to our service area, as well as to provide Western with additional supplies. So as I mentioned, Metropolitan at the time encountered a number of construction challenges. Foremost was high groundwater around the March Air Reserve Basin. Obviously, we're very much aware of those conditions currently. In addition, based on those challenges and the construction change orders that the contractor at the time requested, combined with the reduced water demands due to the recession in 2009, Metropolitan decided to put the project on hold and remove that portion of the contract. Current condition, as we're aware, there is growth that has returned to our region. Both us and Western have requested that the project be completed with completion of the I-215 crossing. There are a number of challenges that need to be addressed by Metropolitan, including the congested corridor that they have to construct within. And again, I'll share with you some of those details here shortly. There's also groundwater contamination, as we're aware, around the March Air Reserve Base, as well as more recently, there's soil contamination that, again, I'll explain here shortly. The project involves complex right-of-way acquisition, not only with Caltrans, but also with the March JPA and the March Air Reserve Base. So there's a number of things that Metropolitan has to complete before they can advance construction. Slide 5 shows you a more detailed perspective on the remaining portion that needs to be constructed. Again, you'll see there Van Buren Boulevard. The proposed tunneling operation across the freeway would consist of a 112-inch diameter tunnel to install the 8-foot diameter pipeline. More recently, Metropolitan has elected that the balance of the alignment that is shown there in dash green would also be tunneled. There's a significant amount of groundwater, and the tunneling approach would reduce the amount of groundwater that they would have to manage. There's also groundwater contaminants, specifically PFAS, that they're going to have to treat before they can dispose of. As you can see here, the alignment is within the March JPA jurisdiction. They also are going to need some temporary easements for construction from the March Air Reserve Base. So to illustrate the complexity of the easements on slide 6, you'll see that Metropolitan previously had secured a number of easements from March JPA and others to construct the pipeline. But now that the design is being reconfigured, they have to realign those easements. So they are currently in the process of working not only with Caltrans, but with March JPA and the March base to secure the permanent easements that they're going to need to operate the system, as well as the temporary construction easements to facilitate construction of the pipeline. So current activities by Metropolitan, they're finalizing the bid documents or the design. They've completed the required CEQA clearances. There's a number of additional support activities that were recently completed. Given that they've modified the alignment, they completed the survey and mapping that's necessary, utilities and geotechnical investigations. They conducted value engineering reviews and workshops. And then the right-of-way acquisition and permitting is underway. They're working directly with Caltrans, Riverside County Transportation Commission, the railway, the March JPA, and the March Air Reserve Base. As I mentioned, they need to secure those permanent and temporary easements to allow and facilitate construction of the facility. We've been regularly engaged with Metropolitan to facilitate and coordinate completion of the facility. In 2019, they provided us with the schedule that was shown that's shown on Exhibit 8 or Slide 8. So as you can see there, in 2019, there was an unfortunate crash of the F-16 aircraft north of Van Buren next to the I-215 freeway. As a result of the crash, there was fuel jet oil that essentially migrated towards one of the locations where Metropolitan plans to advance their tunneling pits. So now Metropolitan has to address the soil contamination in that area before they can advance a project. There's other challenges that Metropolitan has encountered, and the schedule that is shown here on slide 8 has been delayed. They were anticipating to advertise the project in late 2020 and commencing the construction thereafter, but that has not occurred, and I will show you here the more updated schedule that they're working on. So as I mentioned, they've been delayed. Groundwater contamination as well as soil contamination or remediation requirements, the additional environmental review associated with the contaminants they've identified, and the right-of-way acquisition. Metropolitan is currently finalizing their bid documents to incorporate those strict limits on the groundwater treatment that they are going to be required to accommodate. They're also advancing an addendum to their existing environmental impact report. Again, they're finalizing their bid documents. They anticipate to advertise the construction project in the fall of this year, with an award of construction anticipated in early 2022 and completion 2 years thereafter. I should mention that this project is estimated to cost $65 million to complete the remaining portion of the Paris Valley Pipeline, and it is budgeted within Metropolitan's current biannual budget, so they are moving ahead with it. Now, because of the delay, we wanted to go back and re-examine our water supply and demands. And as Laura Barraza just mentioned previously, we completed our water master plan in 2015. So that master plan, and again, Exhibit 10, shows what we had projected at the time to be our demands. And the lighter blue shows our peak day demands. The darker blue is our wholesale demand to other agencies, and then we accounted for 10% buffer contingency for weather variations. So at the time, as you can see here, there's various sources of water supply from the Mills plant, from Skinner, from groundwater, from our desalination. In 2022, we had projected that we would need the additional supply from the Mills plant shown here in orange to increase from 99 CFS to 199. And that was the trigger, that was our target, is that we needed to have that southern reach of the Paris Valley Pipeline completed by 2022. Having said that, the demands that we've experienced over the last few years has not been what was projected in 2015. We've seen a more modest increase over the last several years. The master plan had projected that we would be around 350 CFS of peak day demand during the summer. More current demand is on the order of about 251 CFS peak day demand. That includes 41 CFS for our wholesale customers. So based on the current demands that we're seeing, we've informed Metropolitan that we can accommodate the revised schedule to complete the pipeline in February of 2024. Having said that, we're going to continue to monitor our supply and demand conditions. We're going to be coordinating not only with Metropolitan to facilitate construction of the project, but also with Western, who is also relying on completion of this facility to meet their future demands. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Any questions for Joe?
I have no questions.
No, good presentation. I know this is an ongoing project with lots of moving parts to it, but it's good to know that we're moving forward on it. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
I had a question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Joe, when they so they're going to have to dewater that little section, and
yes.
They're going to have like a mobile treatment plant.
Yes.
And what are they going to do with the wastewater? They're going to send that out. I mean, you can't just pour it out on the ground. It's just going to go back where it was, and you can be dewatering the same spot. Is there a flood control channel or something?
There is not. It's a great question. So the treated groundwater extracted will be. You're absolutely right, Director. They are going to treat it through probably most likely a GAC, granular activated carbon, because the prevalent contaminant around the Marsh Air Reserve Base is PFAS. So as you indicated, Dr. Corona, they will treat that. The treated water then will be discharged in the storm water system. And then, of course, the GAC material, once they're spent, will be removed and regenerated. So that is the anticipated treatment system that they will require of the construction contractor. Any other questions?
Director Record, any questions?
No, I'm fine. Thanks. Okay.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Joe. And finally, on informational items today, we're going to get an update, our quarterly update, I believe, on the billing system replacement project. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning. Thank you, President Pauly, members of the board. So, yes, this is a quarterly update that we provide the board on our customer information system, our CIS billing replacement project. We're happy that this is advancing into the final months of the project implementation. So just by way of background, the board approved this project for us to move forward with the actual implementation of the project in July of 2019. There are three main components of what we're doing. The first is the CIS system itself. That's the core application, I'll call it the billing engine that receives all the meter reads and generates the customer bills and receives the payments and tracks all of that information. The second component is our customer self-service portal. We implemented phase one of that back in January of this past year, and that interfaces with our AMI applications, allows our customers currently to view their usage and manage their usage through phase one, and Charles is going to speak in a moment about the phase two implementation of that system. And then the third component is our mobile work management system. That allows our field personnel to interact directly with the billing application when updating customer accounts, adjusting meter reads, whatever it may be from the field. So it's about a two-year project for us, and again, we are moving into the final months of our implementation. So with the most recent progress, really that first bulleted item is probably foremost. Water budgets are coded now in the new billing system. That is a significant accomplishment. Water budgets are very complex. Not many utilities outside of California, anyway, have such a robust billing mechanism. So to achieve this water budget coded into the new system is a significant step. We are now in what they call integration testing cycle one. There are three phases of the testing cycle. This first one is really to kick the tires, and we expect and we want a number of things to fall out from that first testing cycle. So as mentioned there on the presentation, there are 489 test cases that are being executed under this test cycle one. And as we move into test cycle two, we would expect fewer defects and deficiencies to pop up. And then test cycle three should be virtually clean when we get to that point. We've also began conducting our brown bag sessions. Those are part of the change management initiative that are part of this project. That's to educate not only our own staff and customer service, meters, and administration, but other departments in the district on their use of the system. Again, the billing system is core to the organization, so many departments access this data. And these brown bag sessions are being implemented to educate them, determine their use, and make sure that we're meeting those needs for those departments once the system goes live. Another significant accomplishment was the financial data conversion that was completed since our last report. I'm told this is nearly unheard of, but that first conversion resulted nearly in an equal balance between our 28-year-old coins application, our current billing system, and the new Kayenta system. So we were very pleased to see that those systems virtually balanced on the first iteration of the financial data conversion. And then lastly, we did implement a change request, number 51. We did extend the go-live by 1 month, and Charles will speak to this in a moment as well, but that was to ensure that the duration of the remaining phases of the project were kept whole. We wanted to make sure that we didn't shortchange some of those remaining steps in order to meet a kind of an arbitrary deadline for project go-live. So that was another significant accomplishment in the past quarter, a significant action in the past quarter. So just a big picture overview of the project. You can see we're winding down with the remaining steps. A number of these are being conducted in parallel. Training development is ongoing and will be delivered to staff. The plan there is to deliver that training close to go live. You don't want to train staff on this too early or in advance, have them go back to the existing application and then come months later to begin using the new system. So it's targeted to train within the final couple of months of the project delivery, but that curriculum is currently being developed. Again, as I mentioned, there are three test cycles to the integration testing, and then our current, we're looking to deploy and go live at the end of May timeframe with the system, and then there will be a post-implementation support process that lasts through September. So with that, I will turn it over to Charles to provide some of the project details as well as an overview of that customer portal information that we spoke about.
Thank you, Dan. Good morning once again. As Dan mentioned, we're in the final phase of this project, a short 5 months, and hopefully we'll be pushing play. I'm excited about that because the grays on my face are adding up too much. But anyway,
we'll move forward with project quality assurance, and we'll talk about that. So as you may recall, the district did partner with a third-party firm by the name of Plant Moran to conduct this work. And their primary goal is to assess and evaluate the overall progress of the project
and to provide a health check dashboard on a monthly basis. Now, they do this by conducting project interviews, attending project meetings, and reviewing project assets such as the budget and deliverables as an example. And then they'll compile their report utilizing the key that you see there. So green representing things are good on target, yellow things are below target needing the project management office to intervene, and then red meaning things are off target and needs to be escalated beyond the project management office. So as I mentioned, you know, this is a report that's published on a monthly basis, and we review this in our executive steering committee that Mr. Jones, Laura, Paul, and Dan and others are a part of. And as you'll see from the last report published in December, you know, there's quite a bit of green on here, which is what we want to see. But the one item, the project schedule, I'll address that in the next slide. I will be talking about that shortly. The other items that are on caution are mainly tied to the team consistently utilizing the project tools that are in place, as well as communication. So I'm working with the project management office to ensure that the team continues and consistently utilizes those tools, and that communication is being pushed out to all project team members to ensure that we're all on the same page. And I'm confident by the next time we come to report on this, those items will be in the green. So as Dan mentioned, we did process a change request, change request 51, and primarily what that did was, as he mentioned, was extend the project by 1 month. And really the key driver for us was to ensure that the remaining project activities, specifically training and testing, we wanted to ensure that those maintained the original durations as opposed to truncating those activities, or even another option that was on the table was to run them simultaneously. And we felt that that added unnecessary risk to the project and potentially could have impacted the quality prior to go live. So that was a key driver to extend by 1 month. So we'll go ahead and move on to the project budget. This is a table that you all are very familiar with. And Director Armstrong, I do believe that this was included in your onboarding presentation last month, so you should be familiar with this one as well. So what this is showing is the various categories that make up the project. First column there represents the approved budget of $17.5 million. Next column represents what we've actually spent to date, well, as of November 30th when I pulled this together. $8.3 million spent as of that time, and then the remaining balance of $9 million, just a little over that, to carry us through the balance of the project. And here's a different view of the budget. So this is a cumulative monthly actual to budget. The blue line represents the cumulative budget, and the green represents actual. And you will note that there is a variance there, primarily due to consultants not traveling to district facilities because of the ongoing pandemic. It's also important to note that the contract that we have in place, it's fairly strong. And it, what I mean by that is we do not pay the vendor until they hit certain milestones or deliverables, and that's also contributing to the variance that you see there. But once those milestones and deliverables are met, we do anticipate that that green line will get closer to the blue line. So before we move over to improving customer cell service, are there any questions regarding the schedule or the budget for me?
Okay. No.
All right. So as Dan mentioned, you know, one of the key drivers of this project is improving customer self-service and providing superior customer experience. And we believe that the three systems that he talked about will deliver that. Specifically, what I'd like to share with you is one of those systems, which is the My Account customer portal or the customer self-service portal. Now, you may remember a year ago, we launched phase one, and as Dan mentioned, what customers receive from that is the ability to view their usage, and they can really drill down by day, down to the hourly level even, to better understand their consumption at their particular location. So as we prepare for phase two go live in May, system is continuing to be configured. To use this term, we're kicking the tires and testing the systems to ensure that it will be ready for our customers once we go live. And we're truly excited about some of the additional features that will be available to our customers. And I'm hoping once I review that with you, you'll agree that this does get us moving towards that Amazon-like experience that we talked about in the triennial budgeting phase. Okay, so the first item I wanted to share with you all this morning is smart forms. Now, these are easy-to-use smart forms that our customers will be, these features will be available to our customers 24/7 from a smart device of their choosing. So now, smart forms allow customers to conduct routine transactions such as a name change or contact information update. Some other transactions such as payment arrangement, for example, or customer moves out of their location. So these are all features that will be available to our customers through this system, whereas today they have to call into the customer service department. And as you know, we only open 8 to 5 Monday through Friday, so it kind of limits them. But with a tool such as this, you know, they can do that from a device of their choosing, as I mentioned, 24/7. So we're really excited about this. Oh, there we go. The next item I wanted to share with you was the ability for customers to compare their current bill usage to past bills. And when I was looking at this, it reminded me of, I'm a SoCal Gas consumer myself, so it reminded me of something that I see on the SoCal Gas website. So what you're looking at here in the highlighted area is that the green line represents their current bill usage, and that compares to the blue line, which is their previous bill usage. So again, you know, giving information to our customers so that they can track their usage as they're moving along and potentially make adjustments where they need to. Keeping with the theme of usage, this is a consumption analysis screen. And what the system will do for our customers is identify the previous or the current bill period, what day did a customer have the lowest use, what day did a customer have the highest use, and what their average was. This is for their prior bill period. And so, again, with this information, a consumer can look at it and say, wow, you know, what really happened on this day where we used 26 CCF and start to drill in and understand what was going on. Maybe there was landscaping work getting done to start to answer those questions. So, again, the power at their fingertips to understand what's going on at their particular location. And then finally, the last screen I wanted to share with you is the payment notification preference. In today's age, consumers really want to be in control of how organizations communicate with them, and we believe that this gives them that. The customers will determine how and when we communicate to them. So what you're looking at here is a customer could select, I would like to receive an email versus a text, or I'd like to receive a text and an email. They can determine that from the screen, and also select the types of communications that the district will send to them. So your bill is due, or your bill is coming due in 2 days, or your bill is late 5 days, you know, things like that. Again, really giving them the tools at their fingertips to better manage their account. And then finally, looking ahead, you know, as I mentioned, short 5 months and we'll be pushing play. So, you know, the theme is, you know, kicking the tires and testing the system. So two testing cycles, integration 2, we'll be beginning that in Feb, followed by integration 3 sometime in April. And then, as Dan mentioned, end-user training material is currently being developed. We'll complete that in March and then start training staff. So we'll be training for a 9-week period. And as Dan mentioned, you know, we want to make sure that the information is top of mind prior to go live. So that's what we're looking forward to. And with that, concludes my presentation. Hard questions go to Dan. I'll take the easy ones.
Any questions?
No.
I just want to say again, if you'd come to us a year ago and said to the board, hey, because of COVID, we're going to have to delay this by 6 months to a year, I think this board would have understood. But you didn't do that. And the fact that you have continued on what is a very difficult project through the COVID situation, kudos to you, Charles, Dan, and the whole team down there. So, again, I look forward to this. I don't know, for Director Armstrong, this board charged Charles and Dan when we started this project to come up with, I like to coin, the Amazon experience, so that our customers have an Amazon experience as far as communicating and getting data and getting their billing information in modern standards. And so I think we're about to accomplish that. And I want to thank you again. Thank you for the updates. And I would urge Director Armstrong, if you had not had the opportunity yet, to stop by and visit our customer service center down the street here a little bit. I bet Charles would be happy to accommodate you. We have a great team over there. They do what I call the cash register work for the district, and it's a very important part. So those are my comments. Thank you again for a great presentation.
Thank you for the comments. It truly is a team effort, and we'll be happy to have you over there, Director Armstrong, whenever you're ready.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you very much. With that, we will move on to our receive and file item number 7, to receive and file various reports. I would look for a motion and a second on that.
So moved. Second.
Very good. With that, may I get a roll call vote, Madam Secretary?
Director Pauly?
Yes.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Thank you. Passes 5-0. We will go on to the calendar review. Ms. Martinez, I believe you're going to do that for us today.
Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome.
President Pauly, members of the board. Welcome, Director Armstrong, to the district. I am, let me remove my mask. I'm sorry.
My name is Tammy Martinez, and I am here to do the board calendar review. On page one, we have two events of interest for you. First one being the CalDesL Virtual Annual Conference, and we have you, Director Polly, as attending. And you will find the agenda on pages 5 through 7 in the back of the calendar review, just for reference. On February 17th through the 18th, we have the Urban Water Institute Virtual Spring Conference, with that event flyer being found on page 8. So if anyone's interested in attending that, please let us know. Moving on to page 2, we have the Board Master Calendar. And the first meeting that we have is for you, Director Armstrong, and that's the Mead Valley Municipal Advisory Council on Wednesday, January 6th, which is today, from 6 to 8 p.m. Director Record, we have three upcoming meetings for you, the Joint Inland Caucus and Orange County Caucus, Thursday, January 7th from 11:30 to 1, followed by SARCUP discussion from 1 to 2 p.m., and the MWD Finance and Insurance Committee agenda review from 3:30 to 4:30.
Right.
Also, we have the EMWD Board Administrative Committee meeting, and that's for Directors Polly and Slauson, and that is from 4 to 5:30.
Correct.
Followed by Director Armstrong, we have the Good Hope Municipal Advisory Council meeting from 6 to 8 p.m. On Friday, January 8th, Director Polly, we have the Outreach Update meeting with April Cody from 8 to 9 a.m.
Correct.
Monday, January 11th to Tuesday, January 12th, Director Record, we have the standard MWD committee and board meetings. Director Polly, we have on Wednesday, January 13th, the EMWD update with the general manager, Jones, from 7:30 a.m. to 8:30 a.m. And Thursday, January 14th, Director Slauson, we have the EMWD update with general manager, Jones, and that's from 7:30 to 8:30 as well. Director Corona, the Rancho California Water District board meeting is from 8:30 a.m. to 10:30 a.m., followed by the EMWD Board Planning Committee meeting, Directors Record and Corona, from 3:30 to 5 p.m. Friday, January 15th, Director Polly, we have the SCWC Executive Committee meeting from 10 to 11 a.m. Director Slauson, Tuesday, January 19th, we have the SOPA Commission meeting from 9:30 to 12 p.m. If we turn to page 3, we have the upcoming events for the next few months. That's board meetings, board committee meetings, which all seem to be taking place on schedule. Turning to page 4, we have the joint interagency meetings, and those are all on schedule as well. Out-of-office schedule and the district office holiday schedule, with two holidays coming up. Followed by the agendas for the agenda for CalDesL and the save the date for the Urban Water Institute conference. If there are no questions, that concludes my report.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
With that, we'll go on to directors' attendance reports, and I believe we'll start with Director Armstrong. Colorado River Waters Use Association?
Okay, yes, I did. I attended that. I thought that was very informative. Learned that, of course, the Colorado River is oversubscribed and challenged, and they're working on, believe, their new operational guidelines of the river. And they presented some really interesting approaches and some projects that they're doing in Mexico to help Mexico ensure that they're getting their share of the Colorado River water. So I thought, the other thing was they expect the inflow into the river this year, or in 2021, to be perhaps lowest on record. And so could be some challenges with you know, inflows into the Colorado River next year. And I also had a opportunity to meet with staff over the Quail Valley Sewer Project, and that was very informative. I took time after that to go drive through those communities. I saw the one-way streets and all the terrain and what's out there. It was actually a really fun drive, but I really appreciated that update. It was very helpful. Thank you.
Is your car okay after bottoming out a couple of times?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
No, it's appreciate that. It's always helpful to go look at some things in person. Gives you a good perspective. Thank you for that. I had two meetings. AYSO French Valley reached out to me about some opportunities in some of the park areas and asked me to help coordinate a meeting with Valleywide. And April and staff were on that call, and we started working on some future projects. And basically, they are looking to replicate the restroom opportunities we did at Sheffield Park. And I told them that we would probably work with Valleywide on that, but that is more of a Valleywide project than ours, but had a good discussion. Always want to keep there a good community group, and always I think they are appreciative of some of the recycled water projects we've done at the parks, and I assured them we're going to continue to do that because I want to have green grass or kids to play soccer on regardless of what the state water conditions are. So that also attended the CalDESAL Executive Director Annual Performance Review. Wendy Ritterbush, I think, has done an outstanding job taking over for CalDESAL. The one area that we charge her with is growing some corporate memberships for that, and she does have a plan to work on that, so more to come there. Director Record, your report, please.
There's one meeting, Monday morning group. We had General Manager Keitlinger from Met talk about legislative priorities for the district. Monday morning group has virtual meetings in February with SEC legislators and in April with the feds. That's it.
Very good. Thank you. Director Slauson.
Had the December 22nd meeting with Paul Jones, the GM, to discuss just all the activities of the district, and that's always very informative. We had a special SAPA commission meeting yesterday, and we discussed the procedures for selection of a new general manager to replace Rich Holler, which I should also mention I have a meeting. We're doing interviews on this Friday, the 8th, from 8:30 till 5, so I will not be in a good mood. That's it.
Very good. Very good. With that, we'll move on to director's comments, future agenda items. Anybody have anything additional? I know that we did put one future agenda item on already previously on the agenda. I just wanted to ask staff in that report, I would ask if we could have a very detailed report about what we have done to reach out to people with challenges and perhaps some ideas of what additional we could do to reach out with people with payment challenges when we bring that up on the January 20th meeting. I'd also ask if we could get a detailed report of this, from my understanding, the mechanics of what we could do since we're already into a billing cycle, what that would take if we were to defer billing the additional rate increase for 6 months, kind of the mechanics of our billing system and what that would entail. Because if we do it, it would be a real thing, and I want to understand the dynamics of that. So those would be the two things I would ask for on that presentation. Anything else from director's comments? Very good. Mr. Legal Counsel, I understand we have the need for three closed session items.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. As identified on item 10, A, B, and C of the agenda.
Okay, very good. For that, I think we'll take a few minutes here to change over to closed session. We'll go ahead and proceed with that. The open session of the meeting, and Mr. General Counsel, will you please give us a report from closed session?
Do we need to call in the original open session?
I think are we good with using this line? Yes. Let's use this line.
Okay, let me just give me a second to pull up the agenda. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The board met in closed session on several items as described in Section 10A of the agenda. On existing litigation under 10A, the board met to discuss existing litigation, Eastern Municipal Water District versus City of Hemet et al. No formal action was taken by the board, but instruction was given to staff. The board also discussed one item of potential litigation under Section 54956.9. No action was taken by the board in that regard. And also on item C under Government Code Section 54957, the board discussed the general manager recruitment update. No formal action was taken on that matter as well, but instruction was given to staff and the district's consultant. That concludes my closed session report.
With that, we will adjourn the meeting until 9 a.m. on January 20th.